Welcome to Restore, a podcast seeking to restore the vision, restore the mission, restore the church. And now your host, Javier Diaz.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Restore Podcast, episode 17. My name is Javier, and I am your host. I want to thank everyone once again for listening and sharing this podcast. Our desire always remains the same. It's that we will share stories, speak on relevant topics that will help restore the mission, restore the vision, restore the church. On today's episode, I am truly excited for you to listen to my conversation with Mike Tucker. Mike is the speaker director for Faith for Today, and it is the oldest religious television broadcast in the world. In our conversation, Mike speaks a bit about his journey in ministry, leading to him joining Faith for Today. We also spend a good amount of time talking about grief, the topic of grief, as Mike's wife, Gail, passed away last year. This is something that we all at some point have or will experience, and I really appreciate his willingness to be open and transparent in how he dealt with losing his longtime companion, Gail, and where he is at now. We end by touching a bit on the current climate of the church, and so I am excited for you to listen to this conversation with my friend, Mike Tucker. Mike, I want to welcome you to the Restore Podcast. Thank you so much for taking up your time and being on this episode.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you, Javier, for having me.
Mike, I want to jump right into it, and I want to ask you, why don't you start by telling us a bit about your journey in ministry, pastoral ministry, how you came to it, and how you ended up in Faith for Today?
I always knew that I was called to ministry, even as a kid. Before I could talk, they said I would line up stuffed animals and preach in gibberish to them. and I've had some sermons since then that were not much better, but I think we all have. But anyway, I knew it all along, but I fought against that as a teenager especially, didn't want to do it. And so I decided I would teach Bible, which I thought was pretty close. But during the course of teaching Bible, the conference sent me a ministerial license in the mail without me asking for it.
Okay.
And then a couple of years later just announced to me they were going to ordain me. It's kind of like God just dragging me, kicking and screaming into this.
Hmm.
And then when I left teaching, they asked me to just on the side, part-time, to take over a church for 6 weeks, I said. So I agreed to do that. And 7.5 years later, when I finally left pastoring that church, I knew I was hooked. I had to be in pastoral ministry. I absolutely loved it. And so from there, I went into hospital chaplaincy and did hospice and hospital and psychiatric hospital chaplaincy. And from there, ended up pastoring at Arlington, Texas. And while pastoring there, received the invitation to add Faith for Today to that menu. It was a 2,000-member church.
Yeah.
And I was doing a full-time medium ministry with Faith for Today. And finally, after 5 years of that, I decided I had to pick a job. And so Gail and I, at that point, did Faith for Today full-time. With a very unique television ministry that I've certainly enjoyed for the last 13 years now.
Wow, praise the Lord. Maybe tell us a little bit about what Faith for Today is. Again, many within the confines of our community of faith know what it is, but we do have people that listen that are not necessarily part of our community of faith. They're certainly, they are followers of, you know, Jesus, and perhaps some that are not, and maybe even listen. So maybe let them know a little bit what Faith for Today is, how it started, and where it's at today.
Faith for Today is the oldest religious television broadcast in the world. This past May of 2017, we celebrated 67 years
Wow.
of television broadcast ministry. Started by William and Virginia Fagel at the request of the General Conference back in May of 1950. Their mandate since day one has been to create programming that would reach people who would not go to church or listen to a preacher if their life depended on it.
Hmm.
We still carry that same mandate. I refer to it as a first contact ministry.
Okay.
Our job is to build relationships with people who won't watch preaching shows but still need Jesus even though they don't know they need him. And so that's our job, is to create that kind of a program. And we're doing that through the years. Faith for Today has used drama to do it. Now we're using a talk show format.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that we have more viewers than any other Adventist production.
Wow.
We have 3 to 3.5 million viewers every week, and we don't pay for any airtime. All the airtime is donated to us, or we get it through something called barter, where we keep the program just secular enough that a local station could sell advertising on it.
Okay.
And then we put commercial blocks into the program. And then it's an award-winning program against secular productions. And so we offer it to stations on a barter basis, and a great many of them take it.
Hmm.
And so this is how we stay on the air. We don't have the money to buy airtime. And so through barter and donated programs, airtime, we're able to do that. So the plan for evangelism is threefold. We do, first of all, we put a lot of money into production because we're competing with secular market.
Yeah.
So we produce and air a quality award-winning program every place we can air it. That's number one. Number two, then we advertise on that program live events, such as, for example, a marriage seminar.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the marriage seminar, it's a day of just nonstop information. Toward the end of the day, I say, you've been drinking through a fire hose today.
Hmm.
It's just too much to consume. And so you really need time to absorb this. So we've created a DVD and book-based curriculum and trained people locally to teach this in small groups. You might as well go. It's already paid for. And it will give the opportunity to incorporate these ideas into your daily life. So now a local church has 6 weeks to form a relationship with people and help them with one thing only. That is their marriage. We share all contact information with the local church so that now they have a relationship with someone that they didn't have before. They saw us on television, came to the seminar, and now they have a relationship with the local church. So that's kind of a first contact where we meet needs, and we're adding to this other seminars as we go along, other ways of reaching a broader spectrum of people. But we reach them through the broadcast and live events and transfer that to the local churches so that now there's a relationship that can be cultivated for the causes of the gospel.
That's, phenomenal. What is the name of the television programs? You know, I know it's Faith Life Today, but the actual name of the program that you, tell me.
Our flagship program is called Lifestyle Magazine.
Okay.
Lifestyle Magazine is an interview format, and we interview celebrities, people from television and movies, people from music industry, authors, experts, just people with a great story,
mm-hmm.
primarily in the areas of personal relationship, personal health, and personal finance. But Lifestyle Magazine is the award-winning program that we produce and air.
Okay. Mike, and where I mean, 3.5 million people, I don't think a lot of people knew that you guys get that many viewers. Where can people watch this? Like, if I'm here in Florida, you're in Texas. So here in Florida, where would I be able to watch this, or how can I watch this?
We are on so many different stations and networks that you would have to go to our website, lifestyle.org, and there you'll see a listing of where to watch. Now, in addition to the television stations, you can stream any of the programs that have aired live from our website,
sure.
Or you can watch us. We have a channel on Apple TV. We have one on Roku and one on Amazon Fire. And all of those apps will have our programs as well that you can watch and stream at your convenience.
Excellent. Which really kind of leads me to the next question I was going to ask, talking about Apple and Roku. Along with those lines, how else in this world that we live in today, many calling it post-Christian, fast-paced social media, do you feel that Faith for Today is at a place where it's still reaching the people that you want to reach? If not, why? Or if so, how? And also perhaps how could you guys improve, realm? In the world that we live in today, right? Everything is Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat,
right.
Things of that nature. So,
well, first of all, we know we're reaching our target market because stations keep giving us airtime.
Okay.
If we were not reaching that market, owners and executives of stations and networks would not be giving us airtime for free.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking at our programming, say, yes, this meets the needs of our market. People will watch this. And so they put us on. So that tells us we're reaching them. The other thing is that we are, as you've mentioned, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all the other things that are out there. We're on a great many of these ourselves. As an example, Lifestyle Magazine just a year ago was listed as among the top 20 most influential Twitter feeds in the area of personal fitness and health. And to be in that kind of an echelon, top 20 influencers, in the world, the Twitter universe,
yeah,
is quite saying something. And so we know that we're having an effect in Twitter. Facebook also, we have quite a following, and it's growing, and I get a lot of buzz from that as well. And so we just know from those kinds of metrics that people are tuning in, watching, following, friending, liking, whatever else it takes,
yeah,
and this digital world of ours, in order to access our content. And our content is either articles, short videos, or our television programs. So we know that they're tuning in because of that. We're measuring on those particular measurements, that particular matrix, and it tells us what's going on.
Awesome. What's the name of the fitness guru? Obi, is that his name? That guy's phenomenal.
Obi Obadike is a personal trainer. He's a licensed and certified, board certified personal trainer and nutritionist. He is a young man who has over 2 million Twitter followers. He's nuts. He's nearly 40, and he's more ripped than most anybody I know in their 20s. incredible guy, but such he absolutely loves this program. Mm. He himself is not a Seventh-day Adventist, actually, but he buys into our message. He trains people from Hollywood, personal athletes he trains. Stephen A. Smith from ESPN trains with him, and he got him back in shape. Morris Chestnut, the actor, trains with Obi, and they've written a book together. Mm. So Obi's got quite a wide reach. He's one of the most influential individuals in the area of health and fitness in the Twitter universe.
Yeah.
And so he does indeed help our influence in that area as well. This is a man who's been on other secular productions and demanded a large price for doing that. But he started in television with us.
Mm-hmm.
He loves this ministry and so continues to labor with us, even though we have no money to speak of when it comes to paying for talent. He knows that. But he's committed to our message, and so he continues to make shows with us.
Awesome. Really, I'm sure you guys really appreciate him being part of that. Again,
absolutely.
I've seen him, you know, some of his stuff on Twitter and things of that nature, and being a person who enjoys fitness myself, just, you know, 40, the guy's just incredible. It looks incredible and everything.
He is.
So on a side note, I'll say it here publicly. If you have any influence in him getting on this podcast, this little podcast, I would love that. No pressure, man. No pressure.
No pressure. I'll see what we can do. I'll see what we can do.
Yeah. I would love to have him on as well. Speaking of health, Mike, about a year and a half ago, tragically, your wife, Gail, passed away.
Yes.
And I want to thank you so much. I obviously beforehand, we were in contact with each other, and you were okay with talking about this. And I think that grief is something that our church, and I'm obviously shifting gears here pretty strong, but grief is not something that we talk about. And in our podcast about restoring the vision, restoring the mission of the church, we've touched on different topics. And I think that grief is something that, again, we rarely talk about.
Right.
I think this is a good moment here, and I think you're, you know, perhaps very well situated to talk about this because of what you've gone through. So, tell us a little bit about your wife, Gail. How you felt when you first heard of the diagnosis? It seemed like everything happened so fast. And how you're feeling today. I know that's a lot of questions, and they're very loaded.
A lot of questions.
Thank you. Thank you for being so open and honest about this. And willing.
I'm happy to do it. And by the way, it's not just the church that doesn't talk about this. The world in general doesn't talk about it, because Western world in particular is uncomfortable with strong emotions. And so we don't really deal with these things very well, and people don't want to talk about it. Other cultures seem to deal better with it than we do, and are more highly expressive of it than are we.
Yeah.
I have taught grief recovery for years in my role as a counselor and chaplain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone's had some experience with grief. But I'd never had the experience that I had when my own wife became ill. Gail and I were married for over 40 years. She was actually the picture of health. She played volleyball every Sunday. Didn't matter where we were in the world. We would take a 5 a.m. flight to get home so she could play volleyball every Sunday evening with a group of women she'd played with for over 20 years. And she was addicted to volleyball. She was active, energetic, healthy. She ate right. She stayed active physically. And then when all of a sudden something started happening to her, it was rather jolting for me. Hmm. It was March 3 that her right hand went numb. We thought she just slept on it wrong. And it got better that evening. March 4, we were on a plane for Vancouver, British Columbia to do a Mad About Marriage seminar, and her right hand went numb. And when we presented that evening, she couldn't hold a fork or a microphone in her right hand because it wouldn't work.
Wow.
So I had to stand close to her on that side to help accommodate anything. We didn't tell anyone what was going on, but she presented and looked normal. And then the next day, March 5, we had a 3.5-hour presentation that she made in high heels, holding the microphone in her left hand because it would have fallen out of her right hand.
Hmm.
And I knew something was wrong. I kept saying, I've got to take you to the hospital. She said, wait till we get back to the States.
Hmm.
So March 6, we flew back to Dallas. And when we landed, I said, you're not going home. Which hospital do you want to go to?
Hmm.
She named it. We went there. And immediately they diagnosed strokes after a CAT scan, which was strange to me because she wasn't diabetic, not overweight, not none right. of the, you know, no high cholesterol, no risk factors for strokes. Took another day, 10 days and two hospital stays, testing to discover that the strokes had been caused by a cancer that created a condition known as sticky blood, which formed a blood clot in her thigh. And when that broke off, it was causing the strokes. And the cancer was a primary site of pancreatic cancer. It was stage 4 pancreatic cancer that had already metastasized to her liver. And the involvement of both pancreas and liver were huge. It was amazing that she'd had no symptoms prior to this. Absolutely amazing. But when they say that, basically they're saying, you need to go home and die.
Hmm.
And that's really what her message to her was. And we knew that unless the Lord intervened and performed a miracle, that she would in fact die. So we took her home and went on home health at first and eventually hospice. And she was diagnosed March 16 and died April 10, same year, which is very, very quick.
Yes.
Pancreatic cancer can be devastatingly painful, agonizingly so, but we fortunately were able to control her pain with primarily Advil and Tylenol right until she went into a coma on April 8 and then died on April 10. Hmm. And so that was really a severe blessing, the strokes were, because they saved her from the pain and agony
yeah.
of pancreatic cancer, but they took her rather quickly, so it was a severe mercy. Losing Gail was the most devastating thing I've ever gone through in my life. Even though I've had losses before, and I've dealt with people who have had losses of this nature, and I've helped them through it, and I've counseled them and taught classes, you don't know what that is like until you've gone through it yourself. It is absolutely the most earth-shattering thing I've ever experienced. And the pain was intense. From my teaching, I knew that the rule of thumb for grief is the sooner and more intensely you grieve, the more likely you are to do well with the process. Sooner you get better, the sooner you get to a point where you can function. And so I engaged in a process of what I called leaning into the pain. I would anticipate things that would bring me pain, and I engaged in those things prior to my needing to, schedule-wise and otherwise. And I wrote about my pain. I kept a blog on Facebook that thousands followed, actually.
Yeah.
Those blogs, by the way, are being turned into a book that is going to be released before too long. I'm turning it into the publisher very shortly.
Okay.
But those kinds of things, I think, helped me grieve intensely early. I got back in the pulpit within 2 months doing a camp meeting. I got back on airplanes because 90-95% of my travel had been with her. So getting on an airplane caused me to cry. Getting to my hotel room that was empty caused me. You understand, all yeah. these things, I went to vacation spots that we had gone to before early on just to make sure that I was leaving no stone unturned. I did not want this to be something that would come back and bite me later. And so I grieved intensely early.
So if you don't mind me just interrupting one thing, I think what you're saying here is so important because as a pastor myself and dealing with people who are experiencing grief, sometimes it's denial. But you're
yeah.
saying it's the opposite. It's grief in grief early and intensely, as you said. That's
yes.
that's just very powerful and amazing.
Yeah.
It's it's hard for some of us. Maybe I'm speaking for myself because it would be hard. I can't even imagine that. And so, I mean, how are you able to, I just want to backtrack one part of it. When you're in that hospital or with that doctor's visit and you hear that diagnosis and Gail is there with you, what is the reaction? I mean, how do you accept and even take that kind of news knowing that this was a death sentence and now it's official?
Well, it's an absolute gut kick. And so it kind of takes the wind out of you. And but truthfully for us, it just left us both silent as we kind of let things filter in. And I knew she was doing the same thing as well. Both of us understood what that diagnosis, stage 4 pancreatic cancer that had already metastasized to the liver. We knew what that meant. She's going to die. And sooner rather than later. We understood that. And so it was just a matter of letting it kind of sink in and internalize. For some people, the reaction is going to be anger. Anger with God, anger with cancer, anger with whomever. And that was normally my initial, my go-to emotion in every point of loss and crisis has always been anger. But I had to come to a point in my life where I realized that my anger, especially at God, was due to the fact that I thought God owed me more than what he had given me.
Wow.
When I had to admit that in essence I was living the gospel of prosperity, although I had taught against it.
Wow.
I said, look at all I've done for you, God, and this is what you give me. But that really was the source of my anger. And when I confessed that before God and asked him to forgive me, and then I asked him to make my lived theology congruent with my taught theology. When Gail's diagnosis came, I realized that he had just done that for me. I didn't feel anger with him. I felt gratitude over having had 40 years of marriage and ministry and love, a family, 40 years of life with a woman who was wonderful, who we had traveled the world together. I felt gratitude. And I asked Gail if she was angry. And she looked at me like I was from Mars. She said, absolutely not. She said, I've had 60 years of immaculate health and most people never get a day. A lot of people never get a day. I've had 40 years of a wonderful marriage and ministry. No one gets that. And then she talked about her children and her grandchildren, extended family and friends. She said, should I be angry that all of that only lasted 60 years and not 80?
Wow.
That just seems to me to be ungrateful, and I won't be ungrateful before my Lord. Now, it didn't shock me that that was her response. What shocked me is that those were the same things I had already thought, and that was not normal for me. But God had actually performed a miracle in my heart. So our response was not typical, I think, with a lot of people, and certainly not typical for what mine would have been earlier had it not been for other experiences of loss and anger with God, which God had helped me process through. But it was still a gut kick, and so you're just left with this state of almost disbelief. And then you begin the process of trying to imagine what that's going to be like. Ending a marriage of over 40 years and not having that person with you all the time, you anticipate. That's what is called anticipatory grieving, where you begin to anticipate what that's going to be like and begin to feel the pain of that in advance of actually having the loss itself. And that's not an unhealthy thing to do. It's a healthy thing to do. And then grieving intensely early once it happens. But that was my experience. And I think that that early intense grief, along with the anticipatory grief, although I had a short time to do that, served me well long-term in the grieving process. Around the 9-month mark, I began to notice a discernible improvement in my symptoms. Some things did not come back. I wasn't able to write for over a year. I could write blogs, but nothing like a sermon or a book. I couldn't write in that respect. No new material. I could write about my experience, but that's about it. But that came back after a little over a year. So slowly but surely, things began to come back to me. But I noticed an intense, a lessening of symptoms about the 9-month mark. And they got increasingly better until the 1-year anniversary, when they got worse for about a week. And then relieved again. To say that I'm recovered, I think, is naive. you don't really recover from a loss like this. You find a new normal and a new place of accommodation.
Right.
And you get to the point where you can once again have joy and plan for life again, re-engage in activities you used to love, enjoy family and friends, plan for the future, have hope, re-engage in ministry, and even at some point find new love and move on. And that's something that has happened for me. I've just recently remarried, reconnecting with a friend that Gail and I had made a few years back at a camp meeting while we were doing ministry in a Mad About Marriage, and I was preaching, and ran into a lady there who had contacted us before because she was at the time the director for Quiet Hour Canada, and was finding herself needing sermons and was not trained to be a preacher, and she resonated with my theology. So I began sharing sermons with her. Her name was Pam Lister, and we shared sermons back and forth, talked theology through the years, and then at one point, I realized that I needed a friend, so I just asked her if she would be someone who would be willing to chat with me online from time to time as I traveled. And that friend, and she said she would, neither of us expecting that this would go anyplace else. Mm-hmm. But that friendship eventually grew into something else, and so now I've remarried. And that's brought me a new sense of joy and fulfillment again. But, you know, that journey through grief is going to be different for everyone.
Yeah.
And what I did by grieving intensely early, some people can't do that. I respect that, and that's fine. For me, I the one thing I don't want to be is victimized. Hmm. My personal life experience tells me that victimization is a bad thing for me. And so trying not to be victimized by grief by initiating contact and being a bully to the bully, although it still bloodies your nose, was a better way of handling things for me. Not everyone's going to do that. Not everyone can or should. The rule of thumb is still true. Grieving intensely early is the best way to go for long-term recovery. But everyone's journey is going to be different.
Yeah. Mike, what can you explain a little bit more? And what do you mean by not being victimized? And I guess that may be an obvious, an obvious answer, but maybe expand that a little bit more for those that may need that. And maybe I'm one of them. I mean, I kind of understand what you mean by that, but what you tell us what you mean by that.
Grief is a 600-pound gorilla that beats the daylights out of you.
Yes.
It's a bully.
Yeah.
And it seems to govern every aspect of your life. It takes away your joy. It leaves you incapable of enjoying things you used to enjoy before, and it surprises you. You go to a public place, and suddenly you hear a song or you see something that reminds you of the deceased. And you're weeping openly in public. You try to avoid places you used to go before because they're too difficult. You just feel like you can't do the things you used to enjoy anymore. In other words, I feel like grief tends to victimize us. It robs us
of
interest, relationships, joys, activities, places. And I didn't want to be victimized. So I felt that the best way to deal with grief would be to initiate that contact and reclaim activities and places. Gail and I used to save up frequent flyer miles and hotel points and every now and then fly to New York City and go to a couple of Broadway shows and then go to a restaurant just off Times Square, Carmine's, an Italian restaurant. That's what we loved to do. It wouldn't cost us much because, you know, the flight's paid for and the hotel's paid for, so it's just tickets and eating out. So that's what we did from time to time. Well, she died in April, and in June, I went back to New York City. And I cried through a Broadway show or two. And I ate at Carmine's, and my waitress saw me crying and asked me what was going on, you know, and so she sat down and I told her the story. Anyone that says New Yorkers don't have a heart has not met that waitress. So I also took a cruise by myself because we used to enjoy cruising. I've taken a lot of cruises and I've rarely paid for them. I've been fortunate enough to go as a speaker. And so, you know, I threatened to have business cards printed that say, "We'll preach for cruise," because I enjoy cruising. And so I took a cruise on my own. I paid for it by myself in order to try to reclaim that experience. And I cried through most of it, but still I know that I can do that again. I can go back to New York. I can do the things we used to do. I can preach again. I can write again. But I reclaimed those experiences as my own.
Powerful.
By initiating contact and suffering through it and surviving it.
Yeah.
And not letting grief be the ultimate bully.
Right. And I think as you've explained that, you know, I mean, it's just like this picture came into my mind that instead of allowing it to dominate you, such a like you said, a 600-pound gorilla coming on you, you attacked it.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
Exactly. The best defense is a good offense.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's military and football both, you know.
Right.
And so I decided to go on the offense. And at times, the control that you feel you have may be a bit of an illusion.
Right.
But it's an illusion which I rather enjoyed. And so, and it seemed to, in the long run, to help me and to make the process move with a little better dispatch.
Yeah. Having been on with my wife as well, we enjoy when we can, you know, we definitely have not been as many as you have, you know, cruises and stuff. And this was not part of my questioning, but when you said that you go on a cruise by yourself, having all this grief. And obviously one of the things that people enjoy the most or in part is sitting down and eating with each other. Right.
Yeah.
You know that well, obviously going on a cruise. So what was that like now sitting there? Without Gail after 40 years. And by the way, Mike, you know, I Mike and I met when I invited them to do one of their first Mad About Marriage, you know, seminars several years ago. And they were just getting started at that. As a matter of fact, I tried years later at another church to try to invite you guys, and you guys had like a year and a half waiting list.
Come.
And Gail was just the epitome of just being an incredible person. Immediately we connected my wife with you and her, and you guys were so helpful and we had a great time together. So just knowing the little bit that I knew of her and just what a wonderful person she was, what was that like sitting down there that first night on that cruise by yourself, you know, and eating? Besides crying, I mean, what was your emotions like?
Well, it's a sense of bizarre, you know. It's just bizarre. It's empty, and it's you feel like you're out of place.
Mm.
You feel like you know, a fifth wheel. You don't belong on this car, so to speak. We live by and large in a couple world. You go to church and you sit by yourself in church, and you look around at all the couples with the arm around a wife, and you remember that for 40 years that was you. And all of a sudden you're sitting alone. You go to a restaurant, you're eating by yourself, which I hate to do, and I travel a lot, and sitting at a restaurant eating by myself, I'd almost rather starve, or get something and go back to the room and sit in the room and eat, and that's just really not lovely. It's impossible to describe it other than the fact that this is extremely painful. It's bizarre. I wrote a blog post entitled Awkward, and I confess that awkward is about as big an understatement for that experience as you can have, but it's the only word that came to mind. You feel awkward at family gatherings, awkward in restaurants, awkward at church, awkward on an airplane, because your entire experience was a two, and now you're living one in a two world when everything you'd done had been a two. And so you feel it loose ends. Awkward, alone, empty, and just like nothing seems to make sense anymore. It's just such a bizarre experience. That's about as close as I can come to explaining it, unless you're there. And Javier, I pray you never experience it. But when you do, if you do, you'll know exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
And people listening to this, some have experienced it, others have not. And those who have understand, and those who have not will not understand fully until it happens. And I pray it doesn't happen to you.
Well, I've like I mentioned, you know, in my ministry, we've, like, you know, yourself, we've done a lot of funerals, been around a lot of people in grief, and just being blessed to be able to minister them. But I have to admit, as I'm listening to your story, I can't think of any that has attacked it as much as you did in that span, which is be really interesting as people listen to your story. And I don't think too many have listened to this part of your story of what has happened afterwards and how you dealt with it. Mike, what were the last words, if you remember, that Gail told you before she passed?
Well, among those last words were these. She wrote letters to our two daughters, our son-in-law, and our grandchildren to be read by them about 6 weeks after their death. And by writing, she was not able to use her hands, and the strokes had taken away most of her vision. So that meant that she dictated to me, and I sat with a computer on my lap, and I wrote all those letters for her. So we read them back out loud, and we would edit together. Then after we finished with that, she said, well, I need to write a letter to you. I said, well, that's rather awkward because, you know, there's no one else here to take that dictation, and here I am. And I said, besides, what are you going to say to me that you haven't said every day for the last 40 years? She said, well, you're probably right. I said, so just for the sake of argument, what would be the things you would say? And she thought for a while. And the first thing she said was, no regrets. And by that, I know what she meant, that, you know, when she was gone, she knew that I would begin to do life review, look back at our relationship. And although we had a fabulous marriage, she also knew that I would find those times when I was less than perfect as a spouse and beat myself up over it. And her word to me was, don't do that. We have no regrets. There's nothing to feel badly about. We've taken care of anything that was against us, between us. We are good, and we've had a great life, so don't beat yourself up over it. The second thing she said was, live our life. And that, for us, that had been about three things. It's been faith, and then family, and then ministry, in that order.
Our
faith is the acceptance of the gospel, recognizing that I'm a child of God, redeemed by Jesus as a gift of his loving sacrifice. I am his child, and I belong to him. That's faith. Family is simply my children, my grandchildren, those people who I hold dear, and now my new wife is part of my family. And then ministry is the thing that I am privileged to do that people pay me to do, and that is to talk about Jesus, whether it be on television or camp meetings or in churches or seminars, whatever it may be. That's my job, is to try to talk about and, to the best of my ability, exemplify the life of Jesus. That's what we lived before. It's what she wanted me to live afterward, and I think that that was good advice. If the life was worth living when she was alive, it is of at least equal value to live now that she is gone. And so that is the life that I'm attempting to live. Those three priorities, faith, family, and ministry.
Well, Mike, I really appreciate you taking the time to be able to talk to us about this aspect of grief. And I think it's going to be a blessing to many, especially with all of the loss that has been going on in, you know, Texas with Harvey and Irma here in Florida and along with, you know, Maria now as we're recording this, and along the islands there as well. People going through a lot of grief, maybe hopefully being able to hear how one person went through his personal grief could help them at this moment, you know, in their relationship with God, and what that means as you're going through all of this. So I really appreciate that. And I think Gayle left you some really powerful words there at the end. Live the life that you guys have lived, you know, faith, family, and ministry. Just a few more last questions, and I do want to shift gears just a little bit. You travel all over the world. And I think as we were talking about grief, I think that this is part of, very important part of helping people to restore the vision, restore the mission, restore the church, we being the church. And grief is part of that. So along with that, as you travel around the world, what are ways that you feel, as you see, that the church as a whole can be restored? What are areas that you feel in which the church needs to be restored, whether it's visioning, its mission, it's the local context? And what areas do you feel the church is really succeeding? And when I mean church, I want to talk about it in two ways. Within our community of faith as Seventh-day Adventist, and the broader community of, you know, faith, just followers of Jesus of different backgrounds. Is that a fair question?
That's a fair question. It takes a lot of territory, so let's see if we can get started on it, see where we go. First of all, let's talk specifically about our community of faith, which is the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And within our community of faith, there are some good things happening and some bad things happening. And I think that the change that needs to happen within our church is going to start at the bottom and come up rather than top down. I think that for leadership to try to initiate and mandate almost a revival and reformation is, although they can certainly call for it and encourage people to do it, that starts at grassroots. And it always starts with a falling in love with Jesus first.
Amen.
It begins with the gospel. It doesn't begin with standards. Standards are a byproduct of revival and reformation and never the cause of it. It always begins with a group of people who simply fall in love with Jesus, such as Wesley overhearing the introduction to Luther's commentary on Romans being read and stating, "My heart was strangely warmed." And that began a faith journey for him, finding the gospel, falling in love with Jesus. And then, as he said, they asked about the success of his preaching. He said, "I set myself ablaze and people come to watch me burn." You know, the truth is that the gospel had set him ablaze and he was burning for it. I think that that has to happen again, and it's going to happen with pastors. It's going to happen with congregants. There are, in our faith community, I believe at least two churches right now. And I'm going to be about as honest and open with this as I know how to be. One of them tends to be a top-down and standards-first kind of a church. And the other church is going to be a bottom-up and gospel-related church. My understanding of Jesus' leadership model is the Son of Man came to not to be served, but to serve. If any among you would be great, he must first be the servant of all. He must be everyone's slave. Jesus' leadership model is a servant leader model. It starts at the bottom, giving love and service rather than at the top, giving command and control. That's true for our home, and it's true for the church. The top-down model will work for corporations and military, but it's not. That's Jesus described that as the model for the Gentiles. It's not the model for the church. And so it's going to start with a bottom-up kind of leadership model, which means men and women deciding to be the servant of everyone and to send up love and service up through the ranks. And rather than at the top being giving command and control. Power and control, command, power and control at the top. Basically, when it comes to the church and to the home, those are the elements of every abusive relationship on the planet. And so a top-down, authoritarian, legalistic model is, by definition, an abusive model spiritually and also turns out to be physically, emotionally, spiritually. Abusive when it comes to relationships and even in church administration. So I see these two things tugging at us. One is a top-down model with authoritarianism. The other is a bottom-up model, which is a little bit messier, but seems to be the model, the leadership model of Jesus. It begins with the gospel and with love. I think that that's the answer for our church. We have to embrace that model, as messy as it may seem, as disjointed and unorganized as it may seem, it is still the model of Christ. It is the scriptural, biblical model that he explains to the disciples after the conflict with James and John and their mother, wanting them to be vice kings, so to speak, in his new kingdom. So I find that within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and there are places where I know that that model is being exemplified, where I see local pastors especially, and even at times church leadership, embracing that model, and I'm gratified by that. And then there are other places where I go where I see that that is not being embraced. It tends to be a works-oriented, top-down model. And that's always one of the characteristics of a bottom-up model, biblical model, is the existence of joy. When joy exists in the church, it usually is a good sign about the church and its health and its spiritual vitality and having a leadership model that is patterned after that of Christ. But when it is a rather grim-faced church with little joy, it's not a very inviting place, and it does not speak well of the leadership model. Now, as I look at the wider Christian community, I believe that that's still an apt description for most of the wider Christian community. There are, of course, other elements in play with all of us, whether it be Seventh-day Adventist Church or the wider Christian community. There are extremes on either side, extremes of taking grace and abusing it to the point of license, and the extreme of on the other side of extreme conservatism and legalism and works-oriented religion. That's true across the board, and some denominations are more susceptible to it than others because of their culture and doctrine, and some are more susceptible to one side of that spectrum or to the other, again, depending on particular culture. Mm-hmm. I just think that all of us, though, have to find a place of wholeness that is Christ-centered, gospel-centered, following a leadership model of Christ, and it's going to look messy and look a little different from denomination to denomination. But I truly believe that that is the only way that the church moves forward in a healthy manner and finds revival and reformation, is bottom-up, love first. It's the difference in parenting between authoritarian and authoritative leadership. Okay. Authoritarian is command and control, a father who gives commands and exercises control. That results in rebellious children. Hmm. Authoritative begins with warmth and then adds structure. Starts with the relationship of warmth and eventually adds structure. That is the relationship and the leadership style that produces healthy children. Hmm. We need an authoritative leadership model in the church rather than authoritarian. And when we embrace that and we start with warmth with Jesus and warmth with each other, we make a difference for the church and for the kingdom.
Mike, well, I think to my very loaded question, I think you did an incredible job of being able to answer it, by the way. Truly living up to your TV, being able, and this is only, of course, audio, but you did a great job at being able to get that question and just answer it very, very well. And I'm going to leave it there and just let people kind of simmer on that as they listen to this episode and, you know, perhaps hear some of their comments when they listen. But when I hear you that answer, one of the things that comes out to me, that at the end of the day, it boils down to, at the local level, having, yeah, first and foremost, a personal experience with our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Yes.
It can't be, yes, what I'm hearing you say, it can't be something that is mandated or sent from the top of any organization, yeah, whether, yeah, Adventist or not. It's something, yeah, of course, it can be encouraged, as you said, but ultimately, it has to be done at the local level. People have to fall in love with Jesus personally, and they have to see others in that joy of Jesus, as you were mentioning. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Exactly. And I want you to know that I am finding courage. I'm taking courage from some of the places I visit, especially there are a number of young pastors. Mm-hmm. You and your wife were among that group that I identified early on in the Mad About Mirrors experience. But a number of younger pastors who are committed to the gospel, yeah, I see it in their preaching and in how they lead their congregations and how they treat their people. Some of them are in churches that are just beating the daylights out of them.
Yeah,
they're authoritative, going to an authoritarian church, and they are gospel going to a works church. And works churches beat the daylights out of gospel preachers. And some of them are thinking about getting out of ministry. And my word to you, if you are a gospel pastor getting the stuffings kicked out of you, don't leave the church and don't leave ministry.
Yes.
If you do, you leave it to them. Yeah. And there's too much vested in this church to leave it to a works-oriented, abusive, by nature, authoritarian model. Mm. It is destructive. It is satanic. Mm. And yes, it is difficult and it is costly to you personally. Mm. But Jesus didn't promise it'd be an easy road either.
That's right. That's right.
And so I encourage you to hold fast to the one thing you have, and that is the gospel. Preach it every sermon, regardless of the page of scripture, regardless of the topic. It is Christ and Christ first, Jesus Christ and Him crucified. That's the only thing that we are determined to know, just right, as the Apostle Paul said. You do that, and whether or not you have success by the world's measures or even your denominational measure, you have success. Because you have fulfilled your calling. You have preached Christ, and that's all you've been asked to do.
Praise the Lord. Well, Mike, I think that is a great place to stop, because it is all about Jesus. And I,
yes,
know that this episode has been spirit-filled and that it's going to bless many people. I often, though, like to finish off with kind of a fun question before
Okay.
You mentioned that you and Gail would love to eat at that Italian restaurant in New mm-hmm. York, and obviously now in your new as you've been remarried, you'll mm-hmm. begin to choose best places for you to go and eat in that aspect. But for you right now, what is, if you can pick anywhere to eat, any kind of food, you're from Texas, so please don't tell me Tex-Mex, but maybe that's it. I don't know. What is your favorite?
That is it.
You can have any house. It is.
It's Tex-Mex, man.
Oh, it is.
I could eat it three meals a day.
Tell me your best Tex-Mex food, like place, the food, your favorite.
You know, it's not just Tex-Mex, but it's Mex. But I mean, I used to live in Dallas. I recently sold my house there and moved over here to Grand Prairie. And there were, within walking distance of my home, about six or seven Mexican restaurants that I just absolutely adored. Mm. And so I can't just give you one, but places like Mi Cocina, Taco Diner, Mia's, Urban Taco, and the list goes on and on. Javier's and other places that are, some of them are chains, others are not. Most of the best food is not usually in a chain, unless it's a small chain in my book.
Yeah.
And so some of those smaller independently owned diners and or small chains are usually what I gravitate toward and really enjoy. From gourmet Tex-Mex gourmet Mex.
Yeah.
To just the run-of-the-mill mom-and-pop organization that they just serve authentic Mexican food.
All right.
I just had my physical yesterday,
uh-huh.
and my cholesterolist told me that I've eaten too much Tex-Mex, so there will be less of it in my future. As my wife, Pam, has told me, there will be less Tex-Mex in my future. She's looking at me right now, nodding her head, yes, in agreement, in order to get the cholesterol under control. But yes, I am intemperate if given the opportunity when it comes to Mexican food.
Okay. Well, hey, I appreciate that. And next time that you're down here in the Orlando area, we have to hit each other up, and we'll go text you to a healthier gourmet Tex-Mex here. There's
all right.
There's everything, as you know, here in Orlando.
So. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
We'll go and lunch is on me. So,
all right, buddy.
Thank
I'll
you.
Take you up on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Mike, so much for your time. Blessings as you continue in your ministry. Blessings to you and Pam and your new journey together. And may the Lord continue again to bless you all. Thank you so much for being on this episode.
Thank you, Javier.
Well, friends, I hope that you were both blessed and challenged by what you heard. I know the topic of grief is perhaps something that we don't talk about as much. And so I hope that you will share this episode with someone, anyone you think it would be helpful to. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at Javier, that's JAVIER.Diaz, DIAZ, at floridaconference.com, or you can hit me up on Twitter. My handle is JAVID21. Blessings to all of you. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to this Restore podcast. We hope you've been blessed. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss any of our inspiring episodes.